Washington. I'm Sue Goodwin.
Welcome to Africa Now! Today's show features South Africa, the plight of miners in Stilfontein and beyond. Africa Now is next. Welcome to Shaw Mwiza Mutali. The music in the background is Vukani or Wake Up by Makoi Marubata. The show today contextualizes the plight of mine workers in South Africa with a special emphasis on the situation in the abandoned mine in Stilfontein. On last week's show, we began exploring the situation at the Stilfontein mine, which is 90 miles south of Johannesburg in the Northwest Province. For nearly 3 months, there has been a standoff at the abandoned mine in Stilfontein between the police and informal miners or artisanal miners known as Zamazamas, who South African government say are trespassing and should not mine there. The South African police have blocked entrances to the mine to arrest any miners emerging out, and also this has prevented water and food to be delivered to the miners. The show features my recent conversation with South African activist Christopher Rutledge of the Mining Affected Communities United in Action, MACUA. In the discussion, Christopher Rutledge contextualizes the plight of mine workers in South Africa, particularly those in the abandoned mine in Stilfontein, highlighting South Africa's mining history and its adverse effect on communities from colonial rule to apartheid to the current time. The show also features Mamitere Sebe, president of the General Industrial Workers Union of South Africa, and is part of the Lawyers for Human Rights. Both Christopher Rutledge and Mamitere Sebe are part of the Stilfontein Solidarity Committee. Here is my conversation with Christopher Rutledge. Christopher Rutledge, welcome to the show.
Hi, good afternoon, Mwiza. Thank you very much for inviting me.
And thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule. I know you're dealing with a lot there with the miners and Stilfontein and beyond. And I wanted to, today, we focused this issue a bit in our last program, and we wanted to follow up with what is currently happening in Stilfontein. If you could put us up to speed of the situation with the miners who the police initially had blocked access from them leaving the mines. And yeah. And if you can and really unpack that for us of what the situation is today, because I know there was a court case that was happening, was supposed to take place last week, Thursday, which was would have been the 21st of November. So, if you can help us understand what's happening.
Yeah, thanks. About 10 days ago, a party which is called the Society for the Protection of the Constitution. It's an unrelated party, so not connected to any of the organizations on the ground or the communities, brought an urgent application to the High Court in Pretoria North, asking the court to interdict the police operation that had been unfolding in Stilfontein at that stage for at least 3 months. South Africa, as in general, came to know about this case about 3 weeks ago. But the police had been blocking access to the mine for the past 3 months. So they brought an application to the court, and then the court provided an interim order instructing the police to ensure that the miners were not stopped from accessing or at least leaving the mine, and that efforts were made to then provide food and water to the miners who were trapped underneath. Like I said, they've been denied access to basic human rights issues such as water and food. And on that basis, the Society for the Protection of the Constitution went to court and said, look, these are constitutional rights. The right to life is being denied to these miners. At that stage, it was claimed there was 4,000 odd miners below the surface. And the court, like I say, granted an interim relief. The actual case was supposed to be heard on Tuesday last week, but the respondents, which is the Minister of Police, the Minister of Mineral Resources, and the I think government in general, I think the President, I'm not 100% sure, but they were then asked to they produced affidavits and replying responses, which indicated to the court that actually these miners were not being stopped from access or leaving the mine, and that in fact they were trying to evade arrest. What they also then argued is that the applicant, the Society for the Protection of the Constitution, had no actual facts to rely upon when making the application. So this was the major shortcoming that emerged in the court case. The court obviously couldn't provide an interdict against the lawful operation if there were no facts, and the society was not able to present facts. And like I said, simply because they were a distant party from the events unfolding in Stilfontein. So today, the court released its findings and basically did not grant the order to interdict the police. And the case brought by the Society for the Protection of the Human Rights of the Miners who are trapped below was denied. Now, the police has responded, obviously. They have been vocal today about the fact that, you know, the courts have basically found, at least this is what they claim, that they have been acting lawfully and that all the claims made against them are unfounded. But as we have said, that the court unfortunately was in a difficult position because it didn't have an alternative view, an alternative set of facts. It could only rely on the facts that was put before it by the South African government. And so as MACOA, which is the Mining Affected Communities United in Action, we are currently engaging with our attorneys and lawyers to prepare a case to urgently bring a new application for protection of the rights of the workers that are trapped beneath the surface. So we are currently in that process of trying to re-establish a case, but based this time on accurate testimony from both people who were underground, people who are on the surface supporting the miners, people who have been experiencing this from a first-hand basis, in which we then hope to show the court that, in fact, there are many miners who want to come out but are not being allowed an opportunity to come out. And like I say, these are some finer details of the day-to-day happenings at the site in Stilfontein, which did not unfortunately come out in the previous case. So, you know, we're hoping that we can get this all resolved as soon as possible so we can get to court. Because as it stands at the moment, the police have stopped all operations to retrieve the minors, despite the fact that when the initial court case was brought, they immediately started the process of bringing in experts to retrieve the minors from underground. They made a big fanfare about this process, but since then they have literally done nothing to retrieve the minors from the situation they found themselves in. And now with the court case, they have basically indicated that they will not be retrieving anyone soon, and that their intention and their plan is still, as the minister in the presidency said a couple of days ago, the intention is literally to smoke them out.
And so this is something that has been, we were talking about the last time, the way the police has acted, and also the government has been saying that these people are illegally there, and they're not operating without licenses, and then also that the fact that you just mentioned it briefly in your conversation, outlining the situation now, that they're also criminals evading the law, and even undocumented immigrants as well. One thing we wanted you to expand a bit more on is the situation with the mining artisan miners in the community that you deal with, and how this situation has been an evolving situation. Particularly as we discussed this actually last time, in light of the fact of unemployment being so high, and then people have started seeing that, wait a minute, the resources, these are our resources, we need to mine them ourselves. So what is the truth about what the government is saying, that these people are just there to avoid this, they don't want to leave because they want to avoid being arrested?
Look, the fact of the matter is that I think there's a natural propensity by people not to be arrested. I think anybody who's been in a situation where they've been arrested understands that it is quite traumatic in its own right. But nevertheless, the point is that mining in South Africa, it's not something that can be understood outside of its historical context. And this is important for the listeners who are outside of South Africa and has not been exposed to this history. I think the first thing to note is that commercial mining, large-scale corporate mining, more or less, has been a feature of the South African landscape for the last 150 years. We've had a situation where, under apartheid and colonialism, the mining companies were given rights to mine. Along with that, certain laws were passed to ensure that black young men had no other option but to mine, but to become waged mine workers. So in other words, laws to force people off their land, to deny them of land. You'll remember the 1913 Land Act was part of that, where, you know, South Africans, black South Africans, were denied 80% of the land, and basically corralled in these native reserves, which later became known as Bantustans. But So the colonial state and the apartheid state after that put in place laws to impoverish black people and to force them to become cheap labor on the mines. Now, part of the way that the mines were controlled was to ensure that that the colonial processes ensured that certain people in certain tribes were given particular jobs. So for example, people from the Xhosa Nation would become rock drillers, others from maybe Lesotho would be different jobs, and then they would recruit from Mozambique, they would recruit from Angola, they'd recruit from Zimbabwe, and they'd recruit from across Southern Africa, as far as Zambia, and even as far as Tanzania. Black workers were recruited to come and work on these mines. So in many ways, there was relationships formed with particular communities, what we call labor sending communities today. It's identified as labor sending communities. It's recognized in our law as being an historical legacy of mining. And so what happens is that in a community, you'd have all the men go and mine in South Africa, and that's where they then got their income from. So what happens is that these communities became reliant on mining as a source of income. And even to this day, when the fathers come back from mining in South Africa, they would then send their sons to go and mine in their stead. And this has become a practice. So the process of people from across South Africa's borders coming to mine in South Africa is an historical legacy. And to some extent, it continues today. So that's the one part of it. The other part is that there are currently across South Africa 6,000 what we call abandoned and ownerless mines. So in other words, large corporate companies have come into South Africa. They have stripped the land of its mineral resources. They delved deep into the belly of our earth, 2 to 3 kilometers down. They have mined the bulk of the mining gold, and then they've left, leaving gaping holes within the landscape. Now, around each mine would develop a mining community. Stilfontein is one of those communities where around the mines, and you must remember in this area of Stilfontein, there are multiple mines. I mean, this is on the gold reef, as it were. This is where all of the gold for about hundreds of kilometers runs this gold vein, which mining companies have been extracting. So Stilfontein is on this reef. And the community there relied on mining for many, many years, like I say, hundreds of years. And now the mines have left, leaving these open holes and a community in dire poverty. Unemployment rates reach up to 80%. Now you have these miners who have been retrenched, and many of them now know the holes are there. So what they do is they go back down because there's still lots of ore to be explored. Some of the mines, because corporates are very profit sensitive, the moment it becomes unprofitable, they leave. But that doesn't mean that somebody with a lower overhead structure is not able to profitably mine. So what the miners are doing is they're going into these holes and mining in those areas. And in some instances, up to R1 million a day is able to be mined, we are told. The fact is that there's a lot of money still to be had under the ground. So in a community where there's 80% poverty, people are then recruited to go down into these mines to work. But in the process, they themselves become a new kind of slave wage setup, because now instead of colonial masters, you have now these criminal syndicates who are essentially orchestrating and organizing these mining activities using guns to claim their power. And part of the problem is that the state, in its negligence, in its failures, has retreated from these communities. The state hasn't policed these societies in the longest time. And so what has happened is that this year after the election, suddenly the state has woken up to say, you know what, we actually have a duty to govern. And so they've come in, guns blazing, trying to govern the sector with the use of force. And we've said, look, this is not just simply a criminal problem. This is an economic problem, a structural economic problem, because historically what has happened is mining sector has been reserved for large-scale corporate miners, and the people on whose land these mines have been developed and whose labor has enriched the shareholders, they haven't benefited in the least, and that continues today. So it's a structural problem where you have these deep bands of unemployment while right on the doorstep there is this enormous wealth that is extracted. So it speaks to this inequality in South Africa, where you have huge amounts of wealth, but deep, deep, deep levels of poverty, living cheek by jowl right next to each other. And that, like we say, is a structural economic problem. So you cannot deny people the opportunity to eat when, you know, there are others that are reaping these amazing amounts of wealth from just next door. So it's a complicated question that needs a holistic solution. And all we're saying is that a Wild West type of American approach to law and order, it's not conducive to finding lasting, sustainable solutions that addresses not only the criminality, but also the economic inequality that exists in South Africa today.
And again, that's Christopher Rutledge. He's with the Mining Affected Communities United in Action. He's talking to us directly from Johannesburg in South Africa as we look at the plight of miners in Stilfontein and beyond. And one of the things as your organization works on is, the as we said, is written in the title of your, the name of the organization is the communities who are affected by these mining operations, which they have never gotten the benefit from. One thing, if you could talk to us a bit about the people's charter, that was the people's miners charter, which was initiated some time ago, and some of the points on those charter, and what is the objective of the people's miners charter, not just for Stilfontein, where the present crisis is happening, but in the other communities which have these mines.
Yeah. Now, the People's Mining Charter was a process that Makoa undertook just shortly after its formation in 2012. As you know, 2012 marked the year that the state, the South African state, in what Makoa then understood as being an unequivocal action by the state, which sent a message to South Africans across the board that the state will protect the interest of corporate capital over the interest of the poor and the marginalized generally. Because, you know, workers had come together and sat on the kopje demanding a living wage, and the state decided, as they are doing today in Stilfontein, that law and order was more important than finding lasting, sustainable solutions to the economic crisis that we have. And so the state used its monopoly of power, of force, and open fire on mine workers, killing multiple workers in the broad glare of daylight. That was an indication to us that something had to change, that we could no longer wait for the state to deliver on our liberation, as it were, but that communities were not going to see any change in legislation, in their circumstance, unless they acted in their own interest. And so in 2012, MACOR was formed on this basis. 150 activists from across the country got together, discussed the issues that faced communities, and decided that it was time for a national movement of mining-affected communities to be formed, so that their interests, which are specific but which are also general, could be addressed. So that was in 2012. By 2013, the mandate was given to send teams out across the country, speaking to communities, listening to what their issues are, what their concerns were, what their demands were, what their hopes and aspirations were. And all of these was then collated into what we today call the People's Mining Charter. So a charter that reflects the interest, the will, and the ambition of communities that are affected by the act of mining. You know, mining is by its very nature a violent process, digging into the earth, taking people out of their homes, you know, destroying the environment, and just unleashing toxicity into the environment through that process. So it's a very violent act. People feel it in very significantly real ways. And what we found is, through this charter, is that there were a set of demands that everybody was asking for. And at the core of the things that people were saying is, they were saying, these mines come onto our land, they mine, they extract enormous amounts of wealth, but they leave us poorer, they leave us in poverty. In fact, some of the research that we've done over the years affirms this and says that in every mining community that we've encountered, that we've worked with, that we've done research on, those mining communities over time have become poorer, not richer. The wealth seems to end up in Europe, in North America, and in recently increasingly in China. So communities have to face relocation. They lose their heritage, their way of life, their way of being. In some communities, you know, we have mountains that are sacred. Those mountains have been destroyed by mining. You know, so it's a deep issue of what connects us to our land, what connects us to our earth, what makes us African. These things have been destroyed by the process of mining. So not only are people losing their heritage, they're also losing the access to farming lands to be able to feed themselves. They're also losing access to water. The cattle can't graze. You know, they don't have housing because they're impoverished by this process of dispossession. And so all of these things were articulated in the mining charter. And like I say, one of the key things that emerges out of that is people are saying, we were not consulted. We do not have a right over our land, and we want the right to be able to determine what our own future is, what our own development paths are. And that stands at the center of what MACOR calls for. Our slogan is nothing about us without us. As Americans will know, it is actually an American slogan. When they fought against the British in their fight to free themselves from colonialism. And it still remains today the essence of democracy, the right for people to decide on what is best for them. And it's that call that we anchor in the People's Mining Charter. It is central to what we do. And added to that, there are a number of other areas that we also focus on, such as the right of women to be granted access to land within South African colonial traditional history. Women are generally excluded from owning land, from participating in decisions that affect them. So we center that demand that women must have the right to be able to decide on how their lives are affected. And then lastly, we also identify that communities must have the right, if they so choose, to participate in artisanal mining that is less invasive, that is regulated, and that provides direct benefit to communities.
You're listening to a conversation with South African activist Christopher Rutledge of the Mining Affected Communities United in Action, MACUA. In the discussion, Christopher Rutledge contextualizes the plight of mine workers in South Africa, particularly those in the abandoned mine in Stilfontein, highlighting South Africa's mining history and its adverse effect on communities from colonial rule to apartheid to the current time. The show also features Mamatewa Sebe, president of the General Industrial Workers Union of South Africa, and he's also part of the Lawyers for Human Rights. Both Christopher Rutledge and Mamatewa Sebe are part of the Stilfontein Solidarity Committee. The music in the background is Kurima by Chinoisa Marere. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation. And how is this people's mining charter being used in the solidarity efforts with the communities in Stilfontein right now?
At the moment, our main focus in Stilfontein is to save lives. That for us is the most important priority right now. And the way that we have articulated that is to say that within Stilfontein, within the artisanal mining sector, like I said before, there are these gangs of what we call syndicates that control the mines, the artisanal mines. Not because, you know, that's just the way things are. That's because, the police were not policing the sector. The law did not cover the sector adequately, and there was no attention paid to it. So in the vacuum of the state retreating from these places, syndicates, criminal syndicates have occupied those spaces as the law. And so what happens is they lure young men into the mines, and then basically these men will become workers, essentially become super exploited in the process. So on the one hand, you got the state that is exploiting the community, and on the other hand, you have these unlawful elements that are exploiting the community. So we center the People's Mining Charter in the way that we articulate these issues by affirming that there can be no solution to this problem in Stilfontein and to artisanal mining more generally that excludes the community both from participating in decision making and two, from benefiting from the acts that are perpetrated on their land. So, you know, if we want to undo the legacies of apartheid and colonialism, if we want to undo the extent injustices that still pervade our economic and structural makeup, then we have to find ways that are more inclusive, that are more participatory, and that ensures that the benefit, the value, the wealth and the development that one can extract from these violent processes of mining accrues to communities. So we center communities at it in the process, and we try and then consistently drive the narrative which suggests that a solution must be found that is inclusive and not exclusive.
And finally, you had the statement that was issued last week, and I think also this week, by the Stilfontein Solidarity Committee on the situation. If you could just give us some key points of that, so people have a understanding of what the community is demanding.
So essentially, like I say, the key demands at this stage is, first of all, that water and food must be able to be sent to the miners, to the workers, right? So we're not by any means trying to promote lawlessness. We're saying that, first off, even an accused person has the right to life. You know, in South Africa, we do not, our constitution does not allow the death penalty. Nevertheless, it also does not allow extrajudicial processes. And what we are saying, that by denying people, the miners who are trapped below the surface, many of them, like I say, are simply just workers who went down to work, who were promised a job and are trying to put food on the table for their families who are starving at home. Now, to persecute and to criminalize people who are trying to eat, it's an injustice of immense proportions. In fact, in the court case, the attorney made the argument, and we have done this previously as well, to say that it has a synergy with the case that the South African government took to the International Criminal Court around Israel and Palestine. In that case, South Africa made a case to say that the Israelis are starving the people of Palestine and using that as a weapon of war. The same case was made in South Africa as it regards to Stilfontein. Because here you have people who have not been sentenced for any crime, but yet they are being denied food and water and being denied opportunities to, you know, and enjoy the privileges of the right to life. So we've made that case as a solidarity committee to say that that's the first and most important thing, is the right to life. Let's deal with that first. Then, as a long-term solution, we are saying that there has to be an economic solution to this. Because even if today the police are able to successfully extract all of the miners, and even if they are to able to prosecute those miners, and let's assume not that it will happen because the law is just not in support of it. Let's say they are able to put these miners away in prison for many, many years. The fact of the matter is the problem would not have been solved, because tomorrow, the very next day, other poor people will be going to those mines to look for an opportunity to eat. And unless we solve that problem, that economic problem, we are not going to be able to solve the artisanal mining problem. So the Solidarity Committee essentially made those two points. Well, there was a third point, which says that part of the problem that we've experienced as a country, as a society, and particularly in mining affected communities, is this lack of policing, the withdrawal of the state. The state resources have been for a very long time directed towards protecting property of the property class, and in the process have left working class, poor communities to fend for themselves. And like I say, in that vacuum has emerged organized criminal gangs, which continue to dominate the life in poor communities. And it is horrendous. I mean, the gangs and the violence leaves many communities in trauma, and that can't continue. So there's a multiple issues at play, but the Solidarity Committee focused on those three: save lives with immediate effect, deal with the long-term economic solution, and ensure that the police are policing on a daily basis, not on a once-off basis. You can't come into a community, have a show of force, kill a couple of people, and then walk away and think the problem is solved. So multiple pronged approach is necessary, and the Solidarity Committee focused on those three requests.
Christopher Lutledge, thank you very much for being on the show. And also after this, we're going to have a short clip from one of the meeting that took place last week at in Johannesburg of the Stilfontein Solidarity Committee. We're going to share one of the voices from that event as well. And the person you're going to hear from is Mametle Sebe. And Christopher, who is he with again?
Mametle is with the Lawyers for Human Rights. He's also the president of the General Workers Union in South Africa, GIWUSA.
Thanks. And that's the voice you're going to hear next from that organizing meeting. And it's just a short snippet, but this, to hear exactly what's happening on the ground, we always want to make sure that people have a very nuanced, broad perspective of the situations that are taking place in the African continent. And again, Christopher, thank you very much. And
thank you so much. Appreciate it.
And here is Mamete Sebe.
Yeah, thank you, Congress Bosman, and some Congress Wish, and another Congress on the ground. I think your work continues to be really an inspiration, given the struggle that I've seen just fighting day in, day out in show. That means a pleasure. And I think that for me has to be the context for the discussion, that we've moved a lot from when you had the minister and the president making, you know, a statement that amounted to an incitement for a mass murder. They just were in another way characterized in their sentiment other than that. Now, for me, with your indulgence, just to clarify, the issues that I think are common misconceptions. But before that, the point is that following the demonstration and resistance, first and foremost, on the ground by the community, supported by Nokua, but also solidarity from, I think, wide sections of the movement now. Major federations of trade unions have come out, even by the UNICEF has come out, AMCU has come out, and quite a number, as well as number of organizations, laws for human rights, and so on, have begun to add voices. And I think that, you know, facilitated a major shift in terms of the outlook of government. And I think on the ground, we're able then to negotiate a better deal where now at least there has been food supplied, water supplied, and I think that struggle is ongoing. And I think there's also, I see now, a commitment to supply medication. Now, there are just few things. One is, I think there's, you know, misunderstanding about this whole thing of FAPI. What does it mean? Because people keep saying, how can government say they must come out and people are coming out, but we keep saying they are trapped. What has happened is that before the Met came to the spotlight, what government did with the operation, they simply got in there, from what I could see, what I gathered, chased away family members and other, you know, core artisanal miners whose role is to actually ensure a constant supply of food, of medication, of water, as well as regularly putting out those that have to come out and taking those that comes in and so on. So that had a supply for 3 months, right? Before the matter is got a spotlight. So they chased away all the people that have to support these people. So there was no food supply.
Yeah.
So you are talking about people who have eaten because their food supply would have run out, I think probably after a first month and so on. So you're talking about people who had not eaten for weeks without an end. and they were extremely weak, emaciated, dehydrated, and for many of those that are in chronic or having chronic illnesses, it just was a disastrous situation of a slow death that I think they had to face with. One person had died, but those that were rescued when I was there, it was clear that, you know, these are people who could not have on their own. These are people who on the ground, they couldn't have been, it could have been business as usual, as I think government want to create an impression of. Secondly, is that you need people to pull them out, because it's almost like government just chase away the people on the surface, come out, and people are supposed to come out. How do people 2 kilometers underground on their own make it all the way to the top and so on? Mm. Now, the question that people are asking, if, well, we're seeing hundreds of people, and, you know, because I don't think it's thousands of people. I think when I was there with comrades, is that, and the police, and we're trying to assess, I think everybody agrees that you're talking about hundreds and hundreds, probably they figure realistically between 500 and 1,000. But on this, I'm open to correction. When I spoke with Comrade Boardman, Comrade Mishak, and others on the ground, it seemed more credible that you are looking at a number that may be approximating between 5 and 1,000 probably, right? Now, the question is, why only 4 people, right? It's not that anybody is refusing to come as government wants people to believe. What we have then, that work is a back-breaking labor, taking about 20 or so people, putting non-stop for over an hour just to be able to bring one person. Three. I mean, when I was there, Comrade Botman was asking, you know, the other comrades and myself to motivate the team to carry on continuing after we, you know, they put another person and you know, so that we are able to increase the number of people that had to be pulled out. And I was saying to him, come, this is simply not realistic. If you've seen like how these people went, I mean, we'll probably be killing these ones on the surface. You know, to take the other ones on the ground. We have to be realistic about what can be done. So it is not that there is anybody who doesn't want to be rescued so far, right? I'm not saying they are not, right? But so far, the only way you can legitimately say that people don't want to be rescued is when you throw the rope underground and nobody comes out. Yeah? That is not happened. Every time a rope was thrown, right, a person tied himself and they came up. So that is an issue that I think is very important, because I think people that are not on the ground.
Element to that, I want to just tag on to that. So one of the things that police have been asking or saying is that they should be going out by the Kuba exit. Now, the way that I understand it is that you're dealing here with tens of kilometers of labyrinth tunnels underneath this area. So you must also remember that it's absolutely dark. You've got no light. So what happens is there's no map. So if you're walking down a particular tunnel, what has happened is, as we understand it, some people have walked into areas where it's flooded. Then you can't continue down that path. So then you have to go back. And then you really don't know where you are. So the thing is, it's not as simple as just walking to an exit. There is an immensely complicated network of tunnels in the dark that the miners cannot navigate successfully or safely.
No, I mean, so these things of it are very important, because for us, this session was very important so that we get on the same page with the communities in the movement in terms of why is it a problem that, and I think we need to clarify more of that in our statement. But also, I think the other thing is certainly that, and this I think an element we need to also, you know, make. What is that those people are going to be charged for? Because people create this impression that, you know, the people underground there are hard all criminals that don't want to come back for the Ethiopia. Of course, it is going to be arrested. But this really much to check those people on. Because let's understand what this means. You are talking about, right, a gold that nobody wants to mine anymore, right? So the situation of these workers is more similar to that of, you know, waste pickers, people who do, you know, go around picking waste that nobody wants to. And now the state, I think, out of the pressure publicly, and they want to be seen to be doing something, they are charging them with trespassing. But even that is not going to be able to hold as easy as they think. Because think about it. Part of the problem is that those mines are mainly what you call abandoned, derelict, and ownerless mines. Now, trespassing supposes that you enter somebody's property without their permission, right? So in this case, you can't say on the one hand, the mine is abandoned, on the other hand, it's actually trespassing.
And that was Mametiwe Sebe, president of the General Industrial Workers Union of South Africa, and he's also part of the Lawyers for Human Rights, and he's part of the Stilfontein Solidarity Committee. Earlier on, you heard South African activist Christopher Rutledge of the Mining Affected Communities United in Action, MACUA. The show was contextualizing the plight of miners in South Africa, particularly those in the abandoned mine in Stilfontein, highlighting South Africa's mining history and its adverse effect on communities from colonial rule to apartheid to the current time. Both Christopher Rutledge and Mametiwe Sebe are part of the Stilfontein Solidarity Committee. You can revisit the conversation at African Now's SoundCloud page. That's African Now online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is Ancestral Home by Carlos Nokai. And we play that in solidarity with our Indigenous family. And WPFW stands in solidarity with our Indigenous family this Thursday in commemoration of National Day of Mourning, also known as Thanksgiving, as well as celebrating the gratitude and harvest inherent in the season. Thursday, November 28th, from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., the shows on WPFW will center on Indigenous American voices. The shows on WPFW on November 28th from 2 p.m. to 7 p.m. will have music focusing on gratitude and in recognition this time of harvest. Again, WPFW strives to build a better world one broadcast at a time with a special programming this Thursday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Mwiza Muntali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shayanana with Zain Al-Amin, which looks at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East, particularly spotlighting the plight of Palestinians. And that's followed by the women's collective Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by The Broader File with Tony Broder. And that's followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, which is followed by Combi Lakai with Eugenia Charles, looking at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope, and thanks to our engineer, Kalia Chapman. Thanks to our research fellow volunteers, Chanda Kozer and Funangonda, and our Africa World Now Project collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Oderston. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW, and to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. Beginning Giving Tuesday, December 3rd to the 31st, we ask you to embrace radical generosity and donate to WPFW. You can visit wpfwfm.org to donate. Your year-end of gift is essential for WPFW's ability to continue to build a better world one broadcast at a time. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Stimela, The Coltrane by Hugh Masekela. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe.
WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. A federal judge today found New York City in contempt over conditions in its city jails, saying conditions have only worsened in the 9 years since the city settled accusations of abuse and violence in 2015. In her ruling, Judge Laura Taylor Swain wrote, "The use of force rate and other rates of violence, self-harm, and deaths in custody are demonstrably worse than when the consent judgment went into effect." She ordered all parties to agree on remedies over the next several weeks. In September, Judge Swain also directed city officials to begin developing a plan for a possible federal takeover of Rikers Island. In other news, according to organizers, Amazon workers in 20 countries, including the United States and the United Kingdom, are planning to strike or protest on Black Friday and Cyber Monday as part of the Make Amazon Pay campaign. Participants say the actions are meant to raise awareness of what they describe as Amazon's anti-worker and anti-democratic practices. In a statement, Uni Global Union, one of the Make Amazon Pay organizers, said, quote, "We stand united in demanding that Amazon treat its workers fairly, respect fundamental rights, and stop undermining the systems meant to protect us all," close quote. In news from the Middle East, Lebanon's Hezbollah agreed to a ceasefire yesterday, which took effect today at 4 a.m. local time. Fighting is set to stop for 60 days, allowing time for Israel to gradually withdraw its troops from southern Lebanon while Hezbollah moves its forces farther from Israel's border. According to President Biden, the deal is, quote, "designed to be a permanent cessation of hostilities," close quote. But there are questions about how long the truce may hold. Israel insists that it will take military action in response to any breach of the agreement. Approximately 1.2 million Lebanese have been displaced due to the conflict, and today thousands of the displaced started returning to their homes in southern Lebanon, defying a warning from the Israeli military to stay away from previously evacuated areas. The warning on social media said, quote, "We will inform you when it's safe to return to your homes," close quote. The vast scale of the Israeli military's strategy of forced displacement and intense bombardment that laid waste to towns and cities means that many people may not have much to return to. And Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum is warning President-elect Donald Trump of dire economic consequences for both countries and suggested possible retaliation following his threat of tariffs. President-elect Trump on Monday vowed to sign an executive order on his first day in office in January, implementing a 25% tariff on all imported goods from Mexico and Canada, and a 10% tariff against China. In a response, Sheinbaum said, "Neither threats nor tariffs will solve the immigration or illegal drug issues in the U.S., and that Mexico could retaliate with tariffs of its own. Mexico is the world's largest exporter to the United States, and its economy is heavily dependent on its northern